As I mentioned before.
I'm afraid that I forgot to record all of this wonderful, warm, friendly introduction from Rachel Roberts, the director of NEC's Entrepreneurial Musicianship Program. And then when I began to speak, I forgot to record myself until a little bit after I'd started. So I began by saying what an honor it was to be asked to talk to these recent graduates and what a privilege it was to play even the smallest role in sending them out into their professional lives. We picked my talk up somewhere in there. And I take it seriously. And I also want to say for any jazz students here that unfortunately most of what I say is going to be relevant mainly to classical music, which is my field, but I know that jazz faces many of the same challenges. My nephew is a really accomplished alto sax player who is playing around New York. And I go to his gigs and I see four people sometimes. I know that jazz actually has maybe a harder problem, you know, below the superstar level with an audience than classical music does. And I've had jazz students in my Juilliard classes, but I'm sorry if a lot of what I say is more about classical music. So, you all are graduating in what for classical music is certainly a very interesting time. I only have to say the words Philadelphia Orchestra bankrupt, and then we can all have a moment of silence and mourning. And that is only really the beginning of the problems, because it's general in the orchestra field and general in the classical music field. And Tony, I must say, sorry to be praising you so much, but you deserve it, has been really a courageous figure in saying out loud on your blog, for example, things that people in the industry say quietly in private but don't want to say in public. For example, your statement about the arts needing to prove their legitimacy, and also the phenomenon of donor fatigue with orchestras. People just don't want to give money because they've given too much in the past and nothing changes. Anyhow, this stuff is intensely real. Declining ticket sales, declining donations, an audience that has been aging, by the way, for 50 years. The audience for classical music around 1960 was the same age as the rest of the population, median age, early 30s. And the anecdotal stuff about that is just fabulous, what it was like to have an opera star at the Met, Geraldine Farrar, who had an enthusiastic fan club of teenage girls and kids in their 20s who went to her performances and screamed and strung banners from one side of the balcony to the other at her farewell performance. It was a different world. So I'm not going to speak about the really depressing details, but we all know that it's real, except I must say for the Musicians Union, which is in total denial and thinks that symphony managements are the cause of the problem. It is much bigger than that. What I do want to spend a little time in is the cultural shifts that I think lie beneath the numerical troubles, if you like, the classical music is happening. And what I believe is that classical music has drifted away over a long period of time from the rest of our culture. Probably started in the 1960s when, as we know, many, many big cultural changes hit, which stayed. So among the changes that I believe classical music has missed out on, by and large, are ethnic, racial, cultural diversity, growing informality in the culture, a sense of spontaneity, a sense of doing it yourself, a sense of participation, a sense that anybody can create art. We don't see these things. It's not like our field has not changed since then. We've seen the whole development of the early music and period instrument movement, which has really given a lot of vitality to performance. And there is greater penetration into the classical music mainstream of new music than there was even 10 years ago. And new styles of new music, particularly for me, younger composers who write pieces, well, like Mason Bates, for example, who's been featured by the YouTube Symphony. He's a dance DJ as well as being a composer, and his music combines strains of both, and he's up there on a turntable soloist with his orchestral pieces, and he is composer in residence at the Chicago Symphony, which shows that he has serious scholarly cred as well as street cred. And actually, this is what you would expect to see if classical music were a really contemporary art, because in the past, right, Brahms writes last movements in which he has Hungarian dances. But now the idea that somebody would write a piece in which there's a hip-hop thing, that is kind of really a little bit wild. But in the past, the equivalent would not have been. But largely, our field is still focused on the old rep. And there's nothing wrong with that music, obviously. We love it. It's crucial to the history of Western culture, which, despite the growth of diversity and the incipient rise of a non-white minority in the United States, is still a crucial component of who we are and where we came from. But, and also it's true that in the other arts and in popular culture, there's plenty of appreciation for old movies, books by Jane Austen, paintings by Rembrandt and Van Gogh. This stuff doesn't die. But only in classical music, I think, is it the central focus. And that is a little bit scary, because everywhere else you go to new movies, you read new novels, you go to the theater. Regional theaters, companies in this country, usually do about half their productions by living playwrights. And museums, which many people want to favorably compare classical music to, oh, we're fine, you know, we function just like a museum. Well, you know, they have old art, but they feature contemporary art, and these tend to be the shows that bring people in. I've seen lines around the block at the Museum of Modern Art in New York for Jackson Pollock, you know, who does dribs and drabs and drips all over the campus. The canvas, the musical equivalent of that would be drive the classical music audience out of the hall. And once going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art's website, just to check my perception that they were very contemporary, I found them featuring three shows. One, I believe, by Raphael, one of the great classic painters. The second one, a show from the Costume Institute about the relation of superhero costumes to high fashion. It's their influence on fashion. And finally, a show by Jeff Koons, an American artist whose wife, dare I say this here, is an Italian porn star, and his work is highly sexual. And I'm thinking, this is not the face classical music is putting to the world. Nothing even remotely equivalent. And that, I think, measured over now a couple of generations, is the reason that we are having our problems. We just don't speak in a contemporary way to the contemporary world, which doesn't mean that we need to have highly sexualized stuff with porn stars. It really doesn't mean that. But it means that everything the contemporary world does, we should be doing. And we do a little bit, but we largely don't. This is the reason, certainly, I think, for the aging audience. The core of the audience here, and if we wanted to do statistics, we could actually see the largest percentage of the audience increasing in age in every decade. Until now. But the core of it, the people, God help me, my age, are people who came to classical music when it was common for young people to come to it, which just doesn't happen anymore. They're not being replaced by people younger than them who are going to subscribe and go to as many concerts and be as devoted to the old repertory done in the old ways. And so when we talk about the audience and the problems with getting a new one, we're not just talking about people your age who would be great to get in, and I think that's actually one of your great missions in life, according to me, to make that happen. But we're talking about people my wife's age, people in their mid-40s, people in their 50s. They are not coming. My wife says there is not one chance in a million that her college roommates will ever go to a classical concert. So that is as much of a challenge as getting people in their 20s and teens and, God help me, elementary school students. So we put forth our stuff. I mean, we in the typical classical music business, the Boston Symphony, the New York Philharmonic, and the world does not particularly respond. I loved the comment made by a Finnish college student who was quoted in a scholarly paper by a Finnish scholar I know about why young Finns don't go to classical concerts. And he looked at the advertisements that Finnish orchestras take out in newspapers, which seem to be exactly like the ones that the National Symphony does in Washington. My wife is classical music critic of the Washington Post, so I live there half the time, the other half the time near New York. Or what you see in the New York Times and maybe the Boston Globe, you know, these black and white, very formal pictures of some violinist playing, and then, you know, Sarah Chang plays Prokofiev. So, or even better, Alan Gilbert conducts Beethoven. So this kid in Finland said these were obituaries. Featuring mostly dead people, namely the composers, and just no interest at all to people in his generation. So, okay, I teach a course at Juilliard, as Rachel kindly said, on the future of classical music. It's a graduate course. I've been teaching it since 1997. And after I had gone through in much greater detail for several weeks the things that I just told you about, toward the end of the course, we now start looking at things that are changing and ways to make it better. And there's this one student. The Philadelphia Orchestra had just talked about bankruptcy, so I talked about that in class. We talked about it a lot. And now I said to one student, so about the reading about how to make things better, what did you think? And he says, I'm so discouraged by everything we've talked about here. I don't even understand why I should go back to the studio and practice. So I said to him, I am thrilled that you asked me that question, because in my opinion, this is the time that you practice harder than ever. This is the time that you renew your love of classical music, me too, our dedication to it, our belief in it. And I really feel that in the midst of the great historical changes we're going through, the love we have for it can inspire other people if we only find a way to communicate it. And I think, especially for you all, first of all, if you love it, why can't other people love it? How different are you from other people? You're so much like, at least if you're like the students I've been teaching for years, you're so much like other people your own age. You share the culture that they have that's not a classical music culture. But you also have the classical music culture. So if anybody can build a bridge, it ought to be you. And one of the great things now is that the field is spontaneously changing in so many ways. I can say, as an alleged professional in this stuff, that it's time to bring the changes together and actually to make people more aware of what's going on. But just to give you some very, very, very quick snapshots of what is going on here. I'm in residence at the University of Maryland. I'm supposed to be working with music students there on helping them find an audience their own age, which is a real challenge, but can be done. Their orchestra, conducted by a fabulous guy named James Ross, has been doing these things to make itself more, I'm not even going to use a word like accessible. I think that's looking at it the wrong way, just kind of more personal. So they're concert dress. They all wear black, but it's not formal black. And they pick an accent color for each concert. And anybody who wants to, completely on their own, can wear the accent color in any way they want. So the last time I went, they're doing Mahler 4. And because of the nature element there, they decided that blue and green would be the accent colors. So I look, and one of the double bass players has a green ribbon tied to one of the bows, the pegs on his bass. And one of the second violinists is wearing this gorgeous green scarf draped around her. Other people have green or blue socks. You just look, and you see the whole thing kind of coming alive. And one of the things you get from that is they really care. And then out in the lobby are baby pictures of all of them, with their comments on how they got into music in the first place and why they love it. And I thought, this is just fabulous. You have an orchestra here of personable individuals that you can really relate to. So that's nice. There's a group in Denver whom I've never heard. I've heard their podcast, but I like their concept. They are musicians who play chamber music and who write. So they read their creative writing, their short stories, their poetry, their nonfiction at the concerts, interspersed with their playing. And one of the things I like about that is they're presenting themselves as full individuals, not I'm a classical musician, here are the masterpieces of the repertory, I will now present them to you. But look, I'm a person. I write, I play, here's the whole story. I kind of love that. Then the entrepreneurial musicianship program here is a really great example of change that is more lively than I've seen at other music schools that might feature entrepreneurship, or like Juilliard may not talk about it at all. I think it's really astonishing that you have this here, and I think it's going to grow into something really marvelous. But then just to take something out of left field that I only found out about because my wife has a friend from Germany who came to visit us in Washington, and she brings with her a copy of Der Spiegel, the German news magazine, and she says, have you seen this? And here's an article about the Hamburg Philharmoniker, conducted by Simone Young, who I must say is one of the world's foremost conductors who is a woman. It's a great thing to see. But they did a performance of Brahms II in which the musicians dispersed to 50 sites around the city, just everything you could think of, a wax museum, clubs, hotels, corporate offices, public places. And Simone Young stands at the top of a famous church tower 300 feet off the ground and conducts on video. And the truth is that the only way they could stay together is by having a recording playing. But it attracted corporate support, and 10,000 people went on the streets to go to these sites and hear the musicians play, where, interestingly enough, if you happened to go where the clarinets were, you now knew what the clarinets did in Brahms II in a way that you actually would never find out anywhere else. So people are doing things like this around the world, and some of it's crazy, some of it's great, a lot of it is inspiring. In New York, there is a brand new audience that's emerged in the last few years of people with a general interest in art but who are not classical music people, who will come to classical music events if it's not a mainstream classical music event. So Lincoln Center has figured out how to tap into this. And they do festivals in Tully Hall where people come to hear world music, rock bands, jazz, Manuel Axe playing Schubert, and they just come kind of because they think it's going to be interesting. And, you know, they're smart people. They know if Manuel Axe plays Schubert, this is not the same thing as world music. But the whole concept of the festival, maybe a lot of concerts all based around the idea of spirituality, draws these people in to see classical music who would probably never, ever go to the New York Philharmonic. I've seen them. It's wonderfully hopeful. It's tremendously exciting. It does raise the problem, though, of how an orchestra like the Philharmonic is going to continue if these people are the audience, because they're not the usual. They probably won't be subscribers, but leave that for the future. I am going to repeat that this is actually a great time to be going out in classical music, because if conventional careers maybe not exist in the same way, new kinds of careers are just fabulously possible. And all the changes that are happening, and I just repeat again, spontaneously, all over the world, just show that the world is ready for this. My God, the BBC broadcast a show called Maestro, which is a reality show in which celebrities tried to be conductors. And they had four judges. Two of them are really world-famous conductors, Simone Young from Hamburg and Sir Roger Norrington. And you have not lived until you see a famous British dance DJ being criticized for unclear handling of upbeats as he's accompanying a Mozart aria that a soprano is singing. And this is bringing classical music in an entirely new way, and seriously to people, even though it was as lively a reality show as you'll ever see. I mean, nobody ate worms. And you know who voted the people off? The orchestra.
Yes!
Yes! Yes! So, I am going to propose a challenge to all of you for the future. Actually, a number of challenges. And the first one is probably going to be very controversial, and somebody may shoot me where I stand. And it's that I want to wonder what would happen if we purged three words from our vocabulary: outreach, education, and the arts. And the reason I say such an incredible and possibly shocking thing is I think that in different ways, each one of these concepts has behind it a notion of our superiority. We know what's good, you don't, and we are going to tell you, and we are going to teach you, and until we do that, you can't appreciate the superior stuff that we do, which I think is incredibly damaging, especially at a time when people 40 and under, 50 and under, have the greatest openness to different kinds of music that I've experienced in my lifetime, and are smart. They are smart cultural people, and at a time when popular culture is very smart, when Bjork's albums are actually more complex music than a Tchaikovsky symphony. That is not the time to tell people, as the San Francisco Symphony told me once, they felt they had to do, that they can't understand Tchaik 4 until they've been educated. I just don't buy that for a minute. And I think then that beneath this implicit sense of superiority is also a sense of inferiority, which is kind of like, oh, we're just classical music geeks and nobody likes that we like what we like and nobody's ever gonna like it unless we teach them. And I don't believe that for a minute. We are great people, our music is great music, and what we need to do is go out and talk to people as equals. And figure that if people are buying Bjork's records by the millions, they can perfectly well listen to Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, and for that matter, Schoenberg and Webern and Steve Reich and you name it. I'm going to talk about selling and commerce, and I mean these things in the best way. I don't mean cheap marketing where you lie in order to get and pander to get people to buy your stuff. I mean communicating what you really are to people so that they get excited about it, which is what the best marketing is. So I think we need to communicate our excitement about classical music the way an entrepreneur would sell a new product. Here is something I am really excited about that is going to make a difference in your life. And once you find out about it, you're going to be excited about it too. Now, the final assignment in my Juilliard class, I asked the students to pick a piece that they love and talk about it, preferably something they play, in terms that anybody would understand for 5 minutes, preferably not talking about its history or the technical analysis of it, its musical form, unless these are the things that genuinely excite them. And the things they say have been just revelatory. I remember one string player, a violinist, who said she thought Paganini was the greatest a greater composer than Brahms or Beethoven, and she loved this Paganini concerto. And this is, I said, what did your teacher think of you thinking that? She says, I've never said this to anybody before. It's a really great moment. Or, you know, opposite pole, a violist who had been at Tanglewood and been assigned to a string quartet where they all hated each other. And she said that playing the slow movement of Beethoven Opus 74 had brought them together because of the beauty of the music. Actually, when we heard that, kind of our collective hair in class on our necks just stood up and nobody wanted to follow her. And there are many. There is the violist who passionately believes that the Brahms clarinet and viola sonatas are actually written for the viola and the clarinet was an afterthought, contrary to what everybody thinks, and dared any clarinetist to get up on stage with him to have a duel to see who could be better. It was really fascinating to hear year after year of these people. So ideally, and I've never had the chance to do this, but I hope someday I or somebody does it, start with this, turn it into marketing, turn it into images, phrases, concert programs, ways of presenting a concert, something that comes from your love of the music, your particular approach to it, your particular thoughts about the pieces that you are doing. And then I think we have the beginning of a way of communicating which we do not see because, you know, the Boston Symphony, fine as it is going to be playing the same pieces basically year after year. And I challenge you to look at any of their material there. Marketing brochures, the program book, the press releases they send to people like me, and I challenge you to find them ever saying why this year's performance of Beethoven 4 is going to be different from last year's performance of Beethoven 4. You know, different conductor, probably there is a difference, but they do not talk about that. And so to most people out there, it registers as a blank. Oh, they play classical music, that's really nice. We need to do better. So the final challenge I'm going to give you is about how you play. And I'm not saying you all play badly. This cannot be true. And I'm not saying that we in classical music play badly as a whole, because we don't. We probably have the highest standard of playing in history. But I wonder how often we have jump off the stage excitement. I wonder how often somebody comes into a classical concert, takes one look at the musicians on stage, as does happen when you hear the Berlin Philharmonic, and you say, oh my God, this is going to be something else. And how often does the playing make you feel that? So I have four, and how often is the playing really individual, so that your performance of a standard repertory piece or a new piece would be different from what anybody else would do? And I don't mean radically different, and I don't mean different in some fake way you imagine, which is because it comes from you, and you're not like other people. How often is that going to happen? So four things about playing that I would like to see more of. Number one is the simple job of bringing out what the score says is in a piece. My favorite example, which I never get tired of using, and it really is not because I have beliefs about the future of classical music, but because I'm a musician, a music person, and it annoys me. Classical period orchestral pieces, you look at the scores, contrasts of forte and piano are very basic to how those pieces unfold. And how often do you hear that? I sometimes hear a different quality of attack for the fortes and piano, but I rarely hear louder and soft sounds. And I almost never hear a piano that makes you lean forward to make sure you hear it, and then a forte that blows you back in your seat. Maybe too much of that would be bad, but some of that would be great, and it appears to be what the composers had in mind. Of course, Mozart also expected the audience to applaud when they heard something they liked, which is a whole other realm of this. And he was not alone. Everybody back then would have thought that. Second point, on a concert program, when you do music from different periods, do the pieces appear to inhabit separate worlds? You know, I can go to a recital and I hear a violinist play a Beethoven sonata, go off stage, come back, play a Shostakovich sonata, and I really should be in a different world, because that is miles and miles and miles aesthetically, historically, culturally away. And normally you don't feel a difference. So that, I think, is kind of basic. Then play it your own way. Make the performance yours so nobody else would have done that. Take chances, break the rules. When I taught my course at Eastman, I had a student who said that she was playing the Brahms F minor sonata for her graduation recital, and she wanted to play the movements in reverse order. So her teacher, of course, said, over my dead body, never, you will never graduate from the school if you do it. And I say, I don't know. Who knows what that's going to be like? No, it's not going to destroy the piece. Everybody else is going to play the movements in the same order, so she should have had a chance to try it. But in a much more orthodox way, if you want, I could put out my friend Simona Dinnerstein, who is just an amazing pianist, who plays Bach in her own style, where clearly she is bringing to it everything she knows about all the music after Bach. But you can't say, oh my God, she did this, this isn't allowed. Oh my God, listen to the huge retard she took in the middle of the Goldberg Variations. She doesn't do that, but the performance is totally, totally her. I might say, just parenthetically, that you might try writing music yourself. Now, everybody in pop music does. People in jazz do it. And I know classical music may seem more daunting, but I want to tell you this. My friend Joan Tower, who is one of the leading composers in America, makes musicians who play her music, when she has control of the concert, write their own pieces and present them. And I've been there, and the pieces are actually really good. It's not clear that composing talent is this specially God-given thing that only composers have. You know what composers are? Composers are people who compose. All of you could actually do that, and I think it would be interesting. And you might get a lot out of it. Finally, I would say play with the audience in mind. And I don't mean pander, and I don't mean saying, oh my God, the audience is going to really like it if I do X, Y, or Z. I don't mean that. But be aware that there's a communication going on, that you're talking to people when you play, and that they have a reaction, and actually their reaction might change you. I was so fascinated to find letters that Brahms and others wrote in his time. Brahms is asked what the proper tempi are for his newly written Fourth Symphony. And he responds and he says, here are the tempi, but only when you, the conductor, and the orchestra and the audience do not know the piece. He and others of his time wanted much more contrast in performances when the audience didn't know the music than they would want later on, for the simple reason that they wanted it to be clear. And I'm not saying necessarily that you have to do that, but you might be aware that when you're playing, especially for an audience that doesn't know classical music, that every passage and its relation to the whole may not be as clear to them as it is for an experienced audience. Or, if I could be a little cynical, the experienced audience just sits back and loves it. They may not hear it either. But a new audience certainly wants it, and there's nothing wrong with showing them, especially since every passage should be as vivid as possible anyway. So, with all of this in mind, and much more that I would never think of and that you will think of, I see you all as the pivotal generation who will build classical music's future. And I really mean it. I mean, every generation obviously does. But you are the ones coming into the field at the time of this huge crisis where things have to change, and you're the ones who are going to change it because it's not going to die. How that evolves and how the cultural problems and the like will be solved, we will all figure out as we go. I would be the last person to say, I know what the solutions are. But I think but by engaging in the world in an individual and honest and entrepreneurial way, you can change the outside world about its relationship to classical music. And interestingly, it will change you, which reminds me of something I didn't say about outreach, which I'm going to just slot in. And one of the problems with outreach, I think, is that when Carnegie Hall and the Berlin Philharmonic go into the black community in New York and get kids dancing to the Rite of Spring, it doesn't occur to them that they could bring people from the black community in and teach them how to produce a hip-hop record. They would never occur to them that they have something to learn from the people they're doing the outreach to. And I think that that's actually a shame, given the diversity of our culture and given that hip-hop is the most amazing entrepreneurial American movement in which a whole generation of people living in horrible conditions devise their own kind of music and their own business. But that's a hobby horse of mine that you can ignore if you like. I believe that you all, as this pivotal generation, will renew classical music. You will keep its heritage alive. You can recreate it for the modern world. You can turn it into a fully contemporary art. And thanks to you, it's going to be reborn in ways that none of us have ever dreamed. Thanks.